started, the pressure at the center would become so great that it would start squeezing the atoms into one another, the matter would become degenerate there in the center, and the result is that it would take up a smaller space than it did before, of course, but it would take up so much smaller a space that the new body, which you had thus created, although it was heavier than the present-day Jupiter, would actually be smaller. The nature of degenerate matter, which we can actually calculate the properties of very simply because the pressures are so extreme that it's all uniform. You know, you don't have to worry about differences from one place to another, which is what makes solid-state physics so difficult. The property of degenerate matter is that the heavier a body of it is, the smaller that body becomes. Now, that means that degenerate matter can exist over an enormous range of densities. It becomes degenerate when you just barely put on enough pressure to just barely squeeze the atoms into one another, and the density is only a little bit above what it was when it was an ordinary solid. All the way down through the tremendous range where you squeeze it and squeeze it and squeeze it and make the distances between the nuclei, one nucleus after another sitting there in that geometric array, smaller and smaller, until finally the nuclei are actually touching. That would be equivalent to having a whole bunch of football stadiums next to one another, each with a garden pea in the center, and then squeezing them together so much that all of the space occupied except for the garden peas had disappeared and the peas were touching. That is a range of increase of density of 1,000 trillion, 10 to the 15th, 1 quadrillion. Okay? Stars in which you have squeezed the matter so much that the nuclei are actually touching are now known to exist. The first ones, which are a class of stars called pulsars, were discovered, just 10 years ago. That's right, the 10th anniversary is coming up this year. And so we know that those exist as well. They are not at all as common, and we don't know anything like as many of them as we do of white dwarfs, because most of them do not emit any light. Pulsars emit radio waves. They do it in a very strange way. There are two pulsars we know that emit light. All the ones we know emit radio waves by definition. And the light and or the radio waves are coming from only two spots on the surface of a star. The star is rotating tremendously rapidly. The reason for that is a physical principle called conservation of angular momentum. All stars rotate. The sun, for example, turns around once on its axis in about a month, 27 days is the average. And those stars, that amount of matter, if it is rotating, if you take anything that is moving around an axis and make it move closer to the center, it speeds up. Everybody's seen that at an ice show where you have a skater spinning around on the tip of her skate, and she brings her arms in like this. She has them out to begin with, brings them into closer to the center of rotation. Her arms are not that big a fraction of her total body mass, but even that is enough that conservation of angular momentum speeds her up tremendously. The standard high school physics class demonstration of conservation of angular momentum is for the teacher to stand up with a couple of weights in his arms, his hands, outstretched hands, on a rotating piano stool, and get one of the kids to start him spinning, and he brings them in, and of course it's a race against time to see whether he will be able to demonstrate this to the satisfaction of even the dumbest kid in the class before the piano stool unscrews and terminates the experiment. High school physics teachers are heroic people, and I am fortunate in not having to do this and in being able only to describe it to you verbally. So, conservation of angular momentum means that if you take a rotating star and squeeze all that matter in towards the center, it tremendously speeds up. And so what happens is, as it rotates, given that there are only two spots on the surface that it's radiating from, every time one of those two spots comes around so it's facing you, you get a blip of radio waves or a flash of light or whatever it is, and then you get another one when the other comes around, usually not as strong because it's usually not aimed at you as well, and so you keep getting every twice per rotation, like so, which is a standard way a pulsar sounds when you convert its sound pulses into the sounds that you can hear on an actual radio. The fastest known pulsar rotates 30 times per second. That's the one in the center of the Crab Nebula, which is supernova remnant. The slowest rotate somewhere around 3 or 4 seconds, and they're barely audible. It turns out that as they age, number one, they slow down, and the reaction, that's probably by the interaction of their magnetic field with the magnetic field of the cloud of gas and dust that is surrounding them, for reasons that I'll get to. A pulsar always has a cloud of gas and dust around it, because it's a remnant of something called a supernova, which is a stellar explosion. And as that breaks it, B-R-A-K-E breaks it, and also it becomes fainter and fainter, and so they go out after a fairly short period of time. So there must be lots and lots of neutron stars out there that we don't know. The point that I'm trying to make is that when the star dies, its own gravity pulls it into a very much smaller size than it was when it started. The heavier the star is, and therefore the more gravity it has, of course, the stronger the pressure is. And as a result of that, even though the heavier it is, the more matter it has, the heavier a dead star, the smaller it is. A dead star that is as heavy as the Sun becomes a white dwarf. Most stars are only as heavy as the Sun, or even less so, and so the great majority of dead stars become white dwarfs. Degenerate matter, but nothing more. Stars that are, say, twice as heavy as the Sun become neutron stars. And those stars are now known to exist, pulsars, and there are a few other cases where we can show that a particular object is a neutron star, even though it doesn't emit light. And those are cases where the actual nuclei are touching. What keeps them apart, by the way? Another force, much stronger than the electrostatic repulsion that keeps atoms apart, and that is the nuclear force, which is what is responsible for the different protons and neutrons in a nucleus, in an atomic nucleus, from all merging into a ball, in a sense. Okay, there's a question in the back there?
No.
I answered it? Good. Okay. Well, I think you can see what I'm leading up to. If the heavier a dead star, the smaller it is, and if the nuclear force stops only a certain, if the nuclear force stops the contraction for a certain mass, but you could have a higher pressure, the nuclear force isn't infinite either. No such thing as an infinite force. There is no force known that is stronger than the nuclear force. So if you can generate a pressure high enough to overcome the nuclear force, then what happens is the dead star contracts and contracts and contracts and contracts and contracts, and nothing whatsoever can stop the collapse until finally the entire body of the star, perhaps a million times or more as heavy as the Earth, shrinks to a geometric point and disappears from the universe. That is a black hole. Now, I'm sorry that the lady who was sitting there and wanted a one-sentence explanation gave up on us and left early, because, you know, I gave you a one-sentence explanation after I explained all about neutron stars and so forth. I oversimplified, in fact. I said that is a black hole, and it is not. That is the thing. The black hole, strictly speaking, is that, the totally collapsed star, dead star, plus the region of space around it. The dead star, since it is a mathematical point, is referred to, and so far as we know, it literally is a geometric point. This is not, so far as we know, a mathematical fiction, because we can't think of any physics that would stop the collapse after you get a gravitational force that is strong enough to overcome the nuclear force. So, as far as we know, it literally is a mass point. Now, that bothers people, I know, and I want to come back to that. But the black hole is the region around that mass point. Since it is a mass point, we use that mathematical technical term and we refer to it as a singularity. Okay? And when people don't know where the word comes from, calling something that bizarre by a name like singularity always strikes them as one of the great understatements of 20th century physics. And there are various kinds of them depending on the theoretician who wrote the specific equation describing them. And that's what I was babbling about, Schwarzschild singularities and Kerr singularities and so forth before. The black hole is the region around the singularity which has the property that the gravity within that, the gravity gets fainter as you go out from the thing that's causing it, right? Okay, so the gravity becomes, out to a certain distance, is strong enough that within that distance, nothing, including light, can escape from the gravitational field. and it is the region out to that distance, which is referred to as the Schwarzschild radius, that's the term that has a slightly more complex meaning, but for our purposes, this is what it'll mean. It is the region within the Schwarzschild radius around the singularity that is called the black hole. What I mean by that is that if the singularity can emit light, and I refuse to speculate about whether it can, we do not know enough about the physical properties of matter under conditions like that, but assuming it can emit light, the light would simply go out to a certain height, turn around, and dive back into the singularity. Now, this kind of behavior we're familiar with on a somewhat smaller scale right here on the Earth. Any gravitational field has associated with it a quantity called the escape velocity. In the case of the Earth, the escape velocity is 25,000 miles an hour or 7 miles a second. What that means is, ignoring air resistance, if you take a ball or a rocket or anything else and throw it up above the Earth, if you throw it up at a speed less than 7 miles a second, then it will certainly go up to a certain height, turn around, and fall back down to the Earth. But if you throw it at a speed greater than 7 miles a second, it will never, ever come back, at least in the simple case where the Earth and the ball are the only two objects in the universe. In practice, it'll get out to a place where some other gravitational force, namely the Sun, is stronger and dominates its motion, and, you know, then it gets more complicated. But suppose the Earth and the ball are the only two objects that exist in the universe. I throw the ball up at 7.00001 miles per second, assuming the escape velocity were literally 7.000, which of course it isn't, you know, a tiny bit above the escape velocity, and it goes out and it goes out and it goes out and it goes out. And never does gravity manage to slow it completely to a halt so they can turn around and come back. Now you say, well, gee, that's sort of weird because gravity is always slowing it down. Yes, it is, but remember that gravity, as you move farther out from the Earth, is also getting weaker as you go farther out. So you get out to some distance, you know, a trillion light years away from the Earth or something, and the gravity there is enormously weak, but the ball is only moving at, you know, 5 microns per million years or something. And that speed is just enough to make it creep out a tiny bit further from the Earth. It does slow down as it creeps out because gravity is still pulling it back, but it's pulling it back so weakly that it doesn't manage to slow it down quite enough for the new lower value of gravity as it gets farther out to be able to bring it to itself. And so it's able to go just a little bit further to still lower speed, where it finds yet a lower amount of gravity, which isn't quite enough to pull it back at that lower speed, and so on forever and ever. That's what escape velocity means. Well, in the case of a black hole, the escape velocity within the black hole region, which can be very large if the singularity is very heavy, or can be very tiny if the singularity is very low in mass, for a typical kind of theoretical black hole with a few times the mass of the Sun, the Schwarzschild radius is a few miles. And within that region, the gravity is great enough that the escape velocity is greater than 186,000 miles per second, which is the speed of light. And if you attended my October lecture called Why You Can't Go Faster Than Light, you are, I hope, convinced that if light can't get out of it, nothing can, because nothing else is traveling faster than that. There are other things, such as radio waves, that travel as fast as light, but nothing else can get farther up. Nothing else can go faster. Now, I think you see the problem in trying to prove that there is such a thing as a black hole. In astronomy, we can only observe objects by light that those, or radio waves, or X-rays, or gamma rays, or some sort of electromagnetic radiation, that those objects emit or reflect, which is irrelevant in this case. And if they can't emit light, or rather if light that they do emit gets sucked back into them, then you can't see the darn thing. Now, there are ways around that, and I'll talk about those in a moment, but we got a flock of questions first. I think you were first.
Okay,
so
you're trying to black light, and
In principle, you could shine a flashlight at it and let the light get sucked into the black hole, but if you knew that much, then you know black holes existed already. See? So, you know, it's like the first step in the classical recipe for how to make rabbit stew. First catch your rabbit. That's the hard part. Question here.
How
can you explain a few laws that black holes can deteriorate? I'll get to that. Let's come back to it. For a black hole having the mass of a star, that's irrelevant. And those are the only ones we've talked about so far. So I've got to talk about possible ways of generating black holes of other masses, and I'll do that in a moment. Let's talk about classical black holes, if I can use the term, that is ones that are formed by the simple gravitational collapse of a dead star first, because those are the easiest to understand. Second. Yeah. Correct. A black hole is a region where gravitation has swamped everything else. That's right. Gravity is the weakest of the four types of forces that exist in the universe. The other three are the electromagnetic force, which has two versions, electrostatic and magnetic, and then the two nuclear forces, the one that I call the nuclear force, which is actually the strong nuclear force, and another one called the weak nuclear force. The answer is that all of those others come in two versions, both attraction and repulsion. The electrostatic force does, for example. And simply because they are so intense, the universe arranges itself in such a way that all the attractions balance by repulsions and vice versa, except over very tiny distances such as inside an atom. And you had an example of that when we tried to force my hand through the stage. The gravitational force was the only one acting on my hand until I got so very, very close to the stage that we had to consider the simple fact of the geometric arrangement of the electrostatic charges inside the atom. Up till that, the electrostatic force, because it is so very strong, had canceled itself out. So what happens is nuclear force also comes in both attractive and repulsive versions, and what's happened, although I didn't explicitly state it, is they've managed to cancel one another out as well, and gravity's managed to overcome. That's half the answer, and the other half of the answer is that nuclear forces, although they're enormously stronger than gravity at short range, fall off with distance much more rapidly than gravity itself does, and so gravity can win out at longer range. Okay? Nuclear forces are not stronger than gravity, except when the two objects that are producing them are within distances comparable to the diameter of a proton or a neutron itself. So get them much farther away than that, and gravity wins. But it really is a paradox, or a seeming paradox, that gravity, the weakest force in the universe, is capable of overcoming all the stronger ones in something like a black hole. In fact, in something like a planet. Gravity dominates a planet's structure. That's why planets are round. Okay? And the reason for that is that these electrostatic forces either cancel themselves out, or the nuclear forces are too weak over long distances, or whatever, for those to be important once you get up to the size scale of something the size of a planet. And so, a planet, when you get a body of rock a few hundred miles across, it is essentially, you might as well assume it has zero structural strength, no electrostatic forces, whatever, holding it together. You might as well treat it as though it were a strengthless liquid, entirely acting under the force of gravity, and that's why planets are round. If you tried to quarry out the state of Michigan, you know, cut out the whole thing, big body of rock, you got a crane with an eye bolt at each of the four corners, and try to pull it up in the air, it'd be like trying to pull up so much water. No matter how far you pulled up the four corners, the middle would simply sag down, stay where it was. If you try to pull up the middle, the corners would sag down, so on. Silly putty is an analogy, but silly putty is much stronger than rock under sizes of those orders. The only way you could do it would be to scoop out the entire thing with some sort of giant pie server. And in fact, even that is not even in principle possible, because the pie server would behave the same way. What would you make it of? So it would be made of some solid and it would behave the same way. Okay, and you have. No, I said the rotation increases as you force the diameter to decrease. What's forcing it to decrease in the case we've talked about so far is simple gravity. The black hole can rotate. Probably they always do. We haven't found a star yet that doesn't rotate. The slowest case, which is a really freak circumstance, is the star HR465, which rotates once every 42 years. But in a more typical case, they do it, they fall into two classes. They either rotate, main sequence stars anyway, fall into two classes. One's up to about 1.5 times as heavy as the sun, 1.4 times as heavy as the sun, rotate slowly about, you know, every few tens of days the way the sun does, and above that they rotate every day or every few days.
And we don't know the reason for that sudden cutoff, but it does exist. There are a number of properties of stars which in fact show a sudden cutoff at that mass, which is very interesting. One of them is the ones below that become white dwarfs at the end of their lives, and the ones above that don't. They become neutron stars or black holes, if black holes indeed exist. Now, okay. Let's take one from this side of the room, stay over there. No, I wouldn't say a neutron star shrinks down. You don't stop at the neutron star stage. It depends on how heavy the dead star is. What I was saying is that if the dead star is below a certain mass, then it becomes a white dwarf. If it's between that mass and a certain other mass, well, if it's below 1.44 times as heavy as the Sun, it becomes a white dwarf. That's called the Schoenberg-Chandrasekhar limit. And then if it's between the Chandrasekhar limit and another mass whose exact value is still being fought over, but if I say three times heavy as the Sun, nobody will get mad at me. It may be less than that, but it's certainly no more than three times heavy as the Sun. And there are lots of stars that are more than three times heavy as the Sun. If it's between that level, then it stops at the neutron star stage. Okay, it's between those two masses. If the dead star is heavier than three times as heavy as the Sun, or maybe less, then it does not stop at the neutron star stage, and so far as we can tell, it collapses and becomes a black hole. What happens to the individual protons and neutrons? They are simply squeezed into one another, one after another. We can't follow it in detail because we can't do this in the laboratory beyond the very first few stages. First, you form heavier particles, which are called baryons, which is a generic name for a whole class of heavy particles. In fact, it means simply heavy particles in Greek, which are, under ordinary circumstances, unstable. They break apart into things like protons and neutrons. But under these conditions, they would not be allowed to break apart. They would be forced into, you know, being sucked in together. And beyond that stage, we just have no idea what happened. But the end, it seems clear, has to be a geometric point, a body of literally no size. Now, this always bothers people. In the first place, it sounds as though I'm saying there's nothing there to a lot of people. I'm not saying there's nothing there. I'm saying that there is. Well, if it's three times as heavy as the Sun, a million times the mass of the Earth. It's just that it occupies zero diameter. So it has infinite density, but it has it only at a single point. To get its mass, you've got to multiply infinity times zero, and that's one of the mathematical impossibilities. But it's one of the mathematical impossibilities in algebra. There is a whole branch of mathematics whose content is how to get the right answer in a specific case where you must multiply infinity by zero. And that branch of mathematics is called integral calculus. Even those of you who know calculus may never have thought of it that way, but it is. Any integral is infinity times zero, right? Any derivative is zero over zero, the other impossible one. And so, you know, this kind of thing is perfectly permissible, happens all the time in mathematics and in physics, and when you multiply the mass by the volume, the mass being, when you multiply the density, which is infinite, by the volume, which is zero, you get the mass of the star, whatever that happens to be. And you got to do it right in the particular case to get the right mass. Now, there's a difference between zero and nothing. I'm saying it has zero diameter. I'm not saying there's nothing there. You know, it's like the bit about if a genie appears out of a bottle and gives you your choice between the two following things, which should you take? Number one, complete and total happiness for the rest of your life. Number two, a ham sandwich. Okay, which should you take? The answer is the ham sandwich, because nothing is better than complete and total happiness, and a ham sandwich is better than nothing. Understand that? You understand the difference between zero and nothing. I mean, I understand the fallacy in that reasoning, and you understand the difference between zero and nothing.
It's
a related fallacy. Give me a hard time.
If I'm not mistaken, the
strong force deteriorates slowly. In other words, you can
have slightly.
Strong force deteriorates very rapidly. In other words, there's a cutoff. There's not a literal cutoff, but it deteriorates so rapidly that the point below which is essentially zero is reached much more rapidly than it would if it deteriorated as slowly as gravity does.
You don't move the electrons in slightly or slightly more intense.
Yeah, I'll give you an example of how rapidly the strong force deteriorates. It's what holds together the protons in a nucleus, even though they're all positively charged and they're trying to repel one another electrostatically. All right? just get from one side to the other of a really big nucleus with, say, a couple of hundred particles in it, protons and neutrons, and already the nuclear force, which at short range is holding together so ferociously that it can overcome that repulsion, has become so weak that a particle on one side feels practically no attraction to a particle on the other side, and that is why big nuclei are radioactively unstable.
That's not what I mean. I mean, if you're overcoming it by mass, and it's collapsing on Jupiter, or degenerate matter.
Yeah.
And as it reaches critical fall off, and you fall into the center.
Yes. All right, that was easy enough. Yeah. How can you possibly detect the rotation of a black hole? That is an excellent question. The answer is, I haven't yet told you how you can detect a black hole. So that really belongs a little bit later in the lecture. But the answer is, there are observational effects which they would have on other bodies. The only way you're going to be able to detect a black hole is by its effect on some more normal body which is allowed to emit light or radio waves or whatever, and which you can detect and then figure out indirectly the black hole is affecting it, right? Okay, there are observational effects which in principle you could use to tell whether a black hole was rotating, and if so, how rapidly. That, however, would require me to get into the general relativity, and that was the thing that I just arbitrarily excluded from this lecture, which has become, as you see, a good deal longer than I thought it would be. I ought to give up on estimating the length of my lectures. You'd think I'd know by this time. Does the gravitational field rotate as well? I think, now this is where I need to know more relativity than I do. I think that the concept of rotation of a gravitational field is meaningless. I mean, it just doesn't rotate. Anybody can help me out on this? We got any physicists?
We get a phenomenon called spiritual direct gravity. Probably the closest thing you can describe the rotating gravitational field. That is, have a rotating black hole and try to make an object sit still in front of it, will drift around. So it has a rotational pull.
Good, thanks.
Well, this thing gets into a little bit more relativity than you like, but you nicely talk about these different objects in terms of the space that they occupy. Could you speak about them just briefly in terms of the relationship between them?
I'm sorry, that would require just getting into too much relativity. It gets really weird really fast. You know, I'd love to, but it's 9:30 already. Question there. Well, why not? Listen, in principle, that's no stranger than something having the mass of an electron and no volume, and that's a description of every electron in your body. As far as we can tell, the electron has zero diameter.
Oh, you see,
but see, it's not a point of nothing. It's a point having zero diameter, but it's not that there's nothing there. When I said it disappears from the universe, by the way, that may have been an overly dramatic way of putting it. I don't mean that it isn't still there. I just mean it disappears in the sense that it's the center of a black hole and you can't see it. You know, literally disappears, not vanishes, not goes away, but disappears in the sense that you can't see it anymore. All I can say ultimately to any question of the form, how can such and such exist, is science cannot answer that question. This is a very important fact about the nature of science. We cannot describe why anything happens in the ultimate sense. All that we can do is observe what does happen. You know, if something does happen, I'll tell you something, you know, same sort of problem that tends not to bother us because we're so familiar with it, really drove people nuts around Newton's time and a lot earlier than that, and that was, how can an object cause another object to move at a distance away from it, which is not touching? The action and distance paradox. How can the sun make the earth move around us? Well, the answer is, I don't know how that or anything else can happen. The observed fact is it does. And that's all the science can tell you. The question about black holes, the only question that matters, is not, are they weird? Are they unusual? Are they incomprehensible? Or even, are they frightening? The only question do they exist? So in the ultimate, I realize it's an unsatisfactory answer, and it is the only answer that any scientist can give you on any question of that form. Or I would argue, not only any scientist, but anybody else. This, of course, is where you get the science versus religion thing.
Are you familiar with the theory on obese neutron stars explaining the observed effects?
Obese neutron stars?
Yes.
I love it.
Well, a University of Wisconsin has come up with some theory on obese neutron stars and can explain the observed effects that are being attributed to black holes using obese neutron
stars. Fascinating. Okay, let me come back. The answer is no, I haven't heard about it, but since I haven't talked about those effects yet, you know, we got to jump ahead to that anyway. Let's take about two more questions. How about, you have an next one, I think. See the slide? Yeah, eventually. You're not ready for them yet. You don't know what they show yet. Believe it or not, that sounds like a simple question. The question is, when a star collapses to become a black hole, does it happen rapidly or slowly? Believe it or not, that is a question that I cannot answer without going into a great deal of relativity. I know that sounds incredible because it sounds like such a simple question, but in fact, I cannot answer that one for you. Let me go on and talk about how you would observe a black hole and the observational evidence there is for one. And then talk about the final portion of the lecture, which is other kinds of black holes than the ones that I've just discussed. As I said, the way you would show that a black hole exists is by observing its effect on something else. Now, more than half the stars in the universe are double, one star revolving around another. Suppose you have a case where a star is revolving around what appears to be a perfectly empty point of space. Then the empty point in space could very well be a black hole. And that's not at all ridiculous, because one of the things we can show from stellar astrophysics is that the heavier a star, the faster it goes through its lifetime and dies. And so a star like the Sun, which obviously has one solar mass, will last for 10 billion years. A star that is maybe 1/50th as heavy as that, and that's very common, the red dwarfs, will last verging on a trillion years, and a star that is 50 times heavier than that is lucky if it can get through a tenth of 1 billion years. It dies entirely in 10 million years or so. So it's entirely possible that you could have a case where you had a heavy star and a less heavy star revolving around it. The heavy star has already gone through its lifetime, died, and become a black hole. The other star is still there, still shining, and orbiting around the empty point. Problem is, there's another possibility. Remember I told you about red giants and red supergiants? It is possible for a star, although it is very massive, to become so big and therefore so cool that it emits virtually no light at all and is actually drowned out by a less heavy but more compact companion revolving around it. And we know how heavy a star could be and how heavy the companions could be to have a situation like that. Well, a few years ago, some astronomers went through the double star catalog and found there are lots and lots of cases where there appears to be a star revolving around an empty point. And in every single one of them, the masses, and you see, you can get the masses because you're observing the orbital motion, so you know how heavy the one that you can see is, and you also know how heavy the one you can't see is. In every single case, the masses were such that it was possible that all that you had was a normal star revolving around a star that was simply too faint and the normal star was surrounding it out. Now, it's possible that some of those are, in fact, black holes. But see, we're looking for a case where there's no other possibility, where it's utterly unambiguous in trying to prove that black holes exist. So, how about a case where you have... Okay, I've got to give you a little more background. Double star separation, the distance apart of the two components, varies from practically as far apart as two unseparated stars, all the way down to cases that we know, several hundred of them known, where the two stars are literally touching one another at one point. Those are referred to as contact binaries. Well, contact binaries are very interesting for a whole bunch of reasons, one of which is, remember, the star gets older, it gets bigger, right? And if it's already touching another star and it tries to get bigger, what's going to happen? Well, it's going to dump material on the surface of the other star. And that means that you are going to have explosions on the surface of the other star. And we think that is the origin of the phenomenon called novae. Not supernovae, mind you. That's a completely different thing. But novae. Okay, suppose you have a case where a contact binary consisted of two stars of unequal masses, one of which has already gone through its lifetime, collapsed and become a black hole, and the other of which is still orbiting around it in contact with its gravitational field. Then what's going to happen is the black hole is going to suck huge amounts of matter off the surface of the still shining star. This is the only case where black holes do this thing that a lot of people have heard a little bit about them and not much think that they all do, and that is suck matter in enormous quantities. If you had a black hole passing through the solar system, it would not suck the Earth into it unless it was, you know, tremendously massive. If you had a black hole passing through the galaxy, it wouldn't suck the whole galaxy into it and so forth. The strength of the gravitational field of a black hole falls off at exactly the same rate as the strength of the gravitational field of any other body with the same mass. As a matter of fact, gravitationally, any spherical astronomical object, and we've already shown they have to be spherical after a certain very small size, any spherical astronomical object acts as though it were a black hole. If you want to calculate the gravitational force of the Earth on you at this moment, that is to say your weight, the simple formula, force equals a constant times your mass times the mass of the Earth divided by the square of the distance between you. But what do you use for the distance between you? Not zero. You say, I'm standing on the Earth. The distance between me is zero. Great. Divide by zero squared, you get infinity and infinite force. Not the way you do it at all. Gravitationally, a spherical object acts as though it were a mass point having the location of the center of the real object and having the mass of the real object. And so the distance you must use to calculate the gravitational force on you at this moment is 4,000 miles, the radius of the Earth. If the Earth were to suddenly shrink and become a black hole, never mind that that can't happen gravitationally, but I mean, you know, if you could somehow make it happen, the Moon would continue in exactly the same orbit as it has now, feeling exactly the same gravitational field that it feels now, and so would all of the Earth's satellites, which are now just above the Earth's atmosphere. The only things that would move differently are things that are now on the surface of the Earth. They would move inward with the new surface. And you see, if the new surface gets closer and closer to the center, the new surface gravity keeps getting stronger and stronger. In that sense, the gravity is very strong. But the gravity at a given distance from the center, say if you stay out at 4,000 miles, just ignore the fact the surface is dropping out from under you, that would still remain the same strength. Okay? So when you say a black hole has a very strong gravitational field, you have to be very careful what you mean by that. It doesn't at any very big astronomical distance. Only very, very close in does it have a big, strong gravitational field. So the one case where a black hole is actually a danger to material objects around it is the case where a contact binary has collapsed and one portion has become a black hole. Where one star in a contact binary has collapsed and become a black hole. Of course, if they both done, it doesn't do you any good. But you can't see either of them. But if you can see with the one star that hasn't collapsed and prove from the mass of what it's revolving around that the other star must be a black hole, then you're home free. Okay? What exactly would it look like? Well, the matter is sucked off the other star and falls into the black hole. And of course, it disappears when it reaches the Schwarzschild radius. But as it goes in, it is being compressed, right? It's being squeezed into a very, very, very tiny volume. And so the farther in it gets, we have a continuous stream of matter. So we're talking about matter at all these different distances at a single moment. As the matter gets farther and farther in, the matter that is far in at any given moment is heated up to an enormously high temperature by the compression, millions of degrees. And at such temperatures, matter emits copious amounts of X-rays. Now, the trouble with X-rays is they won't pass through atmosphere. They won't pass through more than 1 centimeter, oh, a few centimeters for some of the very longest wavelengths of the Earth's atmosphere. Which means, by the way, that Superman's X-ray vision would be absolutely useless on the Earth or any other planet that had air. We deduce from this that Krypton has no air, which is very strange since Krypton is the name of a gas. No stranger, however, than the fact that Sunday is coming up, and it's on a Wednesday, not a Sunday at all. So, the matter emits X-rays. We can tell that there's orbital motion involved, we can measure the X-rays, and there are certain properties they ought to have, the distribution of how intense each the X-rays are, each different wavelengths, and so forth and so on, which enable you to differentiate that from other ways that matter can also emit X-rays. X-rays in general are emitted only by matter which is very, very hot and or undergoing very, very violent conditions. For example, exploding galaxies and that sort of thing. And the science of X-ray astronomy has come into being in recent years only simply because you've got to get up above the Earth's atmosphere in order to be able to have such a science. And so you've got to talk to some politician into giving you enough money to launch a satellite or whatever. We have just launched the most sophisticated of a whole series of X-ray satellites that have been launched so far. This particular one is called HEAO-1. HEAO is High Energy Astronomical Observatory. Before that, there were others. There's one called Uhuru, which is the Swahili word for freedom, because it was launched off the coast of Kenya from a platform in the ocean. There are technical reasons why it was desirable to do that. On Kenyan Independence Day, before that, there were others. Uhuru and HEAO-1 and, those two are probably the best known at the moment. Before that, there were rockets, which could make observations for a few moments at a time. And there is one particular case of a star which appears to be revolving around, appears to be a member of a contact binary, which is also emitting very, very strong X-rays, member of a contact binary which can't see anything in the other half, which is emitting very, very strong X-rays, and that is a star called, a case called Cygnus X1, because it was the first X-ray source discovered in the constellation Cygnus the Swan. In that case, if you calculate the mass of the object that it's revolving around, it not only is not greater than 3, if it's less than 3, then the thing could be a neutron star or even a white dwarf. And there are lots of cases that we know where exactly that's the case. Even if it's around 3, it seems to be 3 or 4 or something, people could always argue you've made a mistake in the calculations, which are, they require you to make certain delicate observations of the nature of the star that you can see, for one thing. And remember, that star is being distorted badly by the gravitational field that it's in. So it may not behave quite the same way as other normal stars that you are taking as your standards when you figure out what its mass is from the observations. All this kind of stuff is a problem. So even if, say, 5 times, even if the thing it's revolving around seems to be 5 times as heavy as the Sun, there's still room for possible doubt. But in the and there are a number of such cases. But in the case of Cygnus X1, the object it's moving around seems to have at least 13 times the mass of the Sun. So unless we are making some very gross mistakes in the observations and the interpretations thereof, and astronomers have gone through all the kinds of possible errors they could think of, and nobody's really been able to come up with a reasonable explanation of, you know, a reasonable scenario where that could happen, then Cygnus X1 is indeed a blue supergiant star, a star that's been in the catalogs for a long time, we all know it and love it, is HDE 226868, from which name you will figure out that it's not a well-known star. It's the 226,868th star listed in the extension of the Henry Draper catalog. It wasn't even bright enough to make the main catalog, which already has a third, almost half a million stars. No, it's in the extension, you see. And so it's just one of countless hundreds of thousands of stars that they're very, very faint. You know, nobody would have paid any attention to them if it weren't for the fact that from that particular spot in the sky we're getting strong X-rays, because that is Cygnus X1. And there's good reason to believe that Cygnus X1 is, in fact, a star revolving around a black hole. Recently, from the first HEAO-1 results observed, it has, it looks as though Cercinus X1, Cercinus being a far southern constellation that you can't see from here, which is why I've never heard of it, is the same kind of thing. Okay? So those are our two best candidates for black holes that are the remnants of dead stars. Now, there's more to it than this, obviously. Let's take a question here and then go on to the more to it.
The X-ray source, where?
The X-ray source is the matter that is just disappearing over the Schwarzschild radius, and that's where it's been heated the maximum amount that you can still see it.
Not quite in the Schwarzschild.
Not quite in, so it's still emitting. You can still see its radiation, but the farther in it is, the hotter it is, because the more compressed it is. And so what you're observing is a very, very tiny region, only a few miles in size, which is heated up to this tremendous temperature and therefore emits X-rays.
If it's in the force field limit, if the gravity is enough to be completely turned around, if it's just outside the force field limit, wouldn't the gravity still be strong enough to quite bend it?
Just outside the Schwarzschild radius, you will get some sort of weird effects from relativity, but it turns out that just outside that, they're down far enough that that you can still observe it. You know, if you want to calculate the exact spectrum and all that kind of stuff, you got to worry about that sort of thing. But for this lecture, we don't, thank heaven. Okay, question there. I've got an artist's conception of it that I'll show you when we get to these slides. You wouldn't even see the black circle because it would be so tiny compared to the size of the star. It's only a few miles across, remember. And this supergiant star is several million miles in diameter, at least. Okay. Now, so much for the observation. That is the observational story, except for one thing that I still have to come to, because it's another kind of black hole, maybe. And, you know, it's just terribly hard to do observations of an object that, by definition, you can't see. You need a very special circumstance, and these special circumstances are going to be very rare, or else you're just not going to be able to observe it. Okay, question back there?
Are you talking about mass concentrations
of black holes? Yes. that's the easiest question to answer I've had all night. Okay, it would seem, though, that observational evidence are not... There must be black holes all over the universe, whether we can see them or not. And that would follow from the simple observation, well established, that there are all these heavy stars. Unfortunately, it isn't as simple as that. And the reason that it isn't as simple as that is that it is those very same heavy stars which, at the end of their lives, do a very interesting thing which other stars, less heavy, such as the Sun, the majority of stars, do not do. And that is, they develop internal instabilities at the very end which cause the entire star to blow itself apart in the titanic stellar explosion called a supernova. There have been only four supernovae in our galaxy in all of recorded history. There was one in 1006, there was one in 1054, and that was the closest and therefore the brightest. There was one in 1572, and the last one was in 1604, 5 years before the invention of the astronomical telescope. By the way, you notice those dates are paired. That is coincidence. They were in different parts of the sky and could not possibly have affected one another. There is some evidence for, in old records, for other objects that may or may not have, other phenomena that may or may not have been other supernovae, but those four are for sure. The most spectacular one was the Crab Nebula supernova, so named because, that's the one in 1054, so named because it gave rise to an object called the Crab Nebula, which you can still see. To give you an idea of what a supernova is like, before the star blew up, it was a red supergiant, something like Antares, perhaps 10,000 times as bright as the Sun. And yet it was so far away, at least 5,000 light years, where one light year is 6 trillion miles, that it was not even visible to the naked eye before it blew up. When it blew up, it became so bright that it was visible in broad daylight for 3 weeks from a distance of 5,000 light years. And it was visible at night for 2.5 years. You can still see the remnant of this star that blew up almost 1,000 years ago. I mean, we saw its light 1,000 years ago. Of course, it actually happened 5,000 years before that. We can still see the remnant of this as a huge expanding cloud of gas and dust called the Crab Nebula from its appearance in photographs. Nebula just means any cloud of gas and dust, irrespective of origin. And the Crab Nebula, to give you an idea of the violence of one of these explosions, is still, almost 1,000 years later, expanding away from the center at 600 miles a second. In fact, they never stop expanding. They are going way above their own mutual escape velocity. Okay, so the question is not, would a dead star three times heavy as the Sun become a black hole? The answer is yes, it would. The question is, does it ever happen that a remnant of a supernova
ever manages to be heavy enough that it's three times as heavy as the sun. Supernovae do indeed leave behind remnants. We don't understand why. From our theories of what causes the supernova phenomenon, such as they are, you'd think the explosion would happen in the center where it's hottest, and therefore nothing would be left. But the observed fact is something is left, and that something is pulsars. Every pulsar we know seems to be a supernova remnant. Unfortunately, there's only one case of a pulsar where we've been able to measure the mass. That mass is less than the critical value 3, and of course that doesn't prove a thing. There could be lots of others that are greater. Well, in the case of pulsars, no, there could not, if they're neutron stars. But there could be lots of other cases where a supernova remnant just doesn't leave behind a neutron star, a pulsar, and because it is heavier than 3. There's even more of a complication than that. The supernova explosion seems to happen not at the center, as you would think, but in a shell outside the center, which means that most of the mass of the star gets blown off. Everything is outside the shell. But the portion that is inside the shell gets imploded by this enormous force. Now, suppose you can take any amount of matter, the mass of a galaxy, the mass of a pinhead, you name it, and somehow manage, even for a fraction of a second, to implode it to black hole density. I should say to singularity density. Then, even if you let go, it doesn't matter. It will never be able to expand back. It will always remain a singularity, which is to say, it will always have a black hole around it, because nothing can escape from a black hole, including the matter that it itself is made of. You see? And that was why I said that most of the thinking about black holes have been in terms of simple gravitational collapse. We get a gravitational field which happens to be strong enough to do the job all by itself, and that's a simple way of understanding it. Yes, you can get it. But that doesn't have to be the only way. If you can dream up some other mechanism that will generate a black hole, a singularity of any mass, you got yourself a black hole. So, we got two questions, both of which we don't know the answers to because we don't know enough about supernovae. Number one, does it ever happen that a supernova remnant, after the explosion has happened, is heavy enough that its own gravity will do the job? We don't know the answer to that question. And number two, whether or not the answer number one is yes, does it ever happen that a supernova becomes intense enough that it's capable of imploding any portion of matter so that portion, irrespective of how heavy it is, can become a black hole? And we don't know the answer to that either because we don't know enough about supernovae. We badly need a good close-by supernova in our galaxy right about now. And, you know, who knows? We're overdue for another one in a galaxy of our size. We can observe them in other galaxies, and we've learned a lot about them that way, but, you know, they're so far away, they're hard to observe. And we know, though, from those observations, in a galaxy of our size, there ought to be one on the average about every 25 years. And of those, we ought to be able to see about a third, because the rest of our galaxy is hidden from us by interstellar dust within the galaxy itself. But the tremendous amount of dust in our galaxy. You could read at night by the light of the Milky Way if it weren't for that dust. But the dust is there. Be happy that it's there. That is what you and I and the planet Earth are made of. But it does mean that we can't see a good part of our own galaxy. So, you know, maybe someday we'll have a supernova. You know, lobby your congressman or something.
It seems that theory would require that the implosion and the explosion be uniform, and recent studies of just ordinary novae seem to indicate that such expansions are rarely
correct.
Uniform.
And that's why I was very careful to explain that ordinary novae are a completely different phenomenon from supernovae. An ordinary nova seems to be a superficial phenomenon where you've got a contact binary, one member of which tries to become a red giant, dumps matter on the surface of the other star, you have a big explosion, the dust clears, both stars are still there, looking practically the same as before, you only lose about 1% of the total mass of the system in a nova. But a supernova is a case where the star blows itself apart.
Well, can they determine the uniformity of it from the remnants?
No. The crabs, well, yeah, supernovae remnants are certainly more uniform than nova remnants. But for one thing, there is some reason to believe that there are several different kinds of supernovae.
you know, and some of them may leave behind no remnants whatsoever. If you're interested in that, which is kind of peripheral to this lecture, there was an excellent article by Robert Kirshner of the U of M Astronomy Department, who is a supernova expert, in the December 76, I believe it was, Scientific American, December something Scientific American within the last few years, called Supernovae in Other Galaxies, and he'll tell you all about it and leave just as confused as everybody else is. Yeah, yeah. Question here.
Are you saying that everything above 3 either goes into a supernova or a black hole?
No, I'm saying that everything above a number somewhat under 3, as a matter of fact, becomes a supernova. And so the question is, after the supernova, do you ever, when the dust clears, have a black hole in it? And you can get, and there are two ways that you can generate that black hole. One, if you got a heavy enough remnant, or two, if the supernova managed to squeeze it enough. And in neither case do we know whether it happens.
Is there a possibility that the remnant explode again? If it
didn't first? Is there a possibility the remnant could explode again? Novae do that, but novae are superficial phenomena. So far as we know, a supernova is a one-shot sort of thing, because it is the whole star blowing itself apart. You know, like the bit about the nervous lady that was flying for the first time, and she said, "Captain, how often does a plane like this crash?" The captain said, "Only once, madam."
Also, they see supernova.
Now, finally, okay, question over here. I heard about half of that. Maybe. It's a good question. The question is, if supernovae have so much implosion forces, why do the Crab Nebula, why in the center of that is there a pulsar and not a black hole? And the answer may very well be the supernovae do not have implosion forces strong enough to generate black holes. I might mention, if you take degenerate matter, the only thing that can maintain it as degenerate is constant application of pressure. Let go of the pressure and it stops being degenerate instantaneously. In the case of neutron star matter, the technical term for which is nucleon degenerate matter, by the way, and that is the sixth state of matter. We've now gone through the entire list so far as is known, unless you want to include the matter in singularity as number 7. And those would be, in increasing order of density, gas, the least dense, liquid, solid, plasma, the least dense, normal gas, neutral gas or unionized gas, liquid, solid, degenerate, nucleon degenerate, which is neutron star matter, and then if you want to make a 7th, singularity. There is a range of masses within which the gravitational field itself is not enough to squeeze the thing in to become a neutron star, but if you give it some help and then let go, it will remain a neutron star. Below that range of masses, it springs back from being a neutron star. But within that narrow range, it can't do it by itself, but it can do it and stay that way if you give it some help. And then above that range, it does it even if you don't give it some help, okay? In this particular case, it wasn't a powerful enough supernova, and so the question is, you know, are there any others? And the problem is, these darn pulsars insist on burning themselves out so fast, you know? So if you can't, if you see something, if you think it's a supernova remnant, and it doesn't even have a pulsar there, you don't know whether that's because it never had a pulsar there, i.e. it might be a black hole or something else, maybe a white dwarf, you know, maybe it goes in the other direction, maybe it's not even strong enough to become a neutron star. Or, on the other hand, whether perfectly good neutron star there, which would just stop pulsing. They can't tell. Okay, final bit. Other ways you can get a black hole. Two of them, at least. One, we mentioned quite some time ago that the universe, when it first formed, big cloud of gas, nothing else, seemed to split into clouds which were going to condense and become galaxies. And then, as that happened, stars formed in the galaxy. Okay? Well, there's no obvious reason why those clouds should have condensed to a certain point and stopped. Well, I mean, we know the reasons, because they were rotating and eventually you had, quote, centrifugal force, end quote, which is neither centrifugal nor a force, and I always hate to use the term, but you know what I mean, which was great enough that it wasn't able to collapse any further and so forth and it starts. But that's not the point. Were there clouds which formed at the very beginning of the universe which simply didn't have enough rotation to be able to stop collapsing all the way? Could you have clouds, maybe 100 billion times the mass of the sun, maybe the mass of an entire cluster of galaxies, that would be something of the order of several trillion times the mass of the sun, all of which collapse to become supermassive black holes? Why not? You wouldn't see them, so you wouldn't know they're there. Okay? Or within a galaxy, What's to say that all of the matter remained behind on the outside to form a galaxy? How about having some of it collapse to form a supermassive black hole, say several billion times the mass of the Sun, in the center of the galaxy? There are things called globular clusters of stars, beautiful objects, arrangements of a million or so stars, we assume, of which we can see the brightest 10,000 or so, arranged in a beautiful spherical symmetry, and you get more and more and more stars towards the center. Some of them have extremely intense bright points in their centers. M15 is a good example in Pegasus. Is that a case where there is a black hole, which is perhaps sucking matter in around it and therefore giving off, not X-rays perhaps, but light? In fact, recent discovery, some globular clusters, including M15, have intense X-ray sources in their very centers. Okay? So do some galaxies. And there are also galaxies which have extremely bright centers. The most recent example of that kind of thing is the supergiant elliptical galaxy. Elliptical means its shape. It's basically just a giant globular cluster, only it has a trillion stars instead of a million in it. And this particular one is 50 million light years away in the Virgo cluster of galaxies. Well, M87 has a very bright center, which we've known for some time, and is a strong radio source, seems to be, there's a jet of bright matter which is thrown out from it, another fainter one on the other side, it's hard to see, and seems to have been violent explosive events going on in there, lots and lots of release of energy. Very recently, some astronomers did a study of the motions of the stars in that galaxy 50 million light years away, which is not exactly the easiest thing in the world to do because the stars are so faint. And they found that those stars are orbiting around something in the center of the galaxy with the mass of 5 billion times as heavy as the Sun. Now, what is that something? Well, the obvious possibility is there is a bright thing there in the center. The obvious possibility is there's just an awful lot of stars in there. The problem is when you count how many stars there are in there, which you do by measuring how bright it is, okay, and then figuring out, you know, how many stars are required to give you that much light, you find there isn't anything like enough stellar matter there. In other words, there is some dark, very heavy object at the center of M87. Sounds like a black hole. Finally, it's been suggested, and this is due to a brilliant British theoretician named Stephen Hawking, who several years ago considered the fact that there might be ways, considered ways that there might be to squeeze very small amounts of matter, say pinhead size or smaller, into black holes. And he discovered a very interesting thing. If it is smaller than about as heavy as a pinhead, the black hole can actually evaporate. And the way that that happens, contrary to everything it sounds as though I've said so far, the reason is that so far I've not only ignored relativity, which I really shouldn't have, I've ignored quantum mechanics, which describes the behavior of objects at very small sizes and masses, and you can't do that either when you get down to very small sizes and masses. What happens is that, according to quantum mechanics, space is full of creations and destructions of pairs of charged particles, which go on all the time for no particular reason. And you never observe them because they keep being created and then destroyed. Actually, there's something called the Lamb shift in which you can indirectly observe this really does happen. What happens is that all through space, every once in a while, you get an electron and a positron created, and they immediately destroy each other. Created, destroyed, all the time. Except in the neighborhood of a black hole. In the neighborhood of a black hole, they can be created. One can get sucked into the black hole fast enough that the other one can't annihilate itself and all of a sudden becomes, excuse the expression, real. That is to say, observable. And so it goes flying away from the black hole. I have seen this described in a number of publications as, you see, black hole matter can escape from a black hole after all. That's not the way it goes, really, because the matter is coming from just outside the black hole. However, where does it get its energy? See, the energy for the formation, this is a case of energy being turned into matter. Okay, and usually it turns right back again into energy, so you never notice it. The energy for this is coming from the gravitational field of the black hole, which is to say the black hole is losing mass. Now, the way it goes is, you start out with a black hole as anything like stellar mass or even pinhead mass, and the amount of mass that it loses per second is so tiny that you can ignore this, and that's why I have ignored it up to this point. But as the mass becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, the amount of mass decreased becomes greater and greater and greater, or let's say more and more noticeable, right? Higher and higher fraction of what mass you've got. And so if you start out with something, say, a little bit less heavy than a pinhead, and it gets less and less massive, very, very slowly at first, and then faster and faster and faster and faster and faster and faster, until finally, at the very end, in about 1/1000th of a second, it loses all of its mass and disappears. Actually stops being a black hole. I mean, all the matter is gone. It's all been radiated off into space. Well, what happens there is, at the very end, you get a big shower, see, and that's what you can hope to observe. It is possible that we may be able to observe this. It's even barely possible that we have observed this as a phenomenon called gamma ray bursts, about which we know very, very little, and we're going to learn a little bit more about from, of all things, the Pioneer Venus mission. We're going to send a spacecraft to Venus with a gamma ray detector on it to find out at least where the darn things are coming from. So far, we don't know if they're coming from, you know, just the vicinity of the Earth or 3 billion light years away or anywhere in between. You had a question? I bet I can't answer it from the speed at which your light, your hand went up there when I mentioned the quantum mechanics. Did I answer? Okay, good.
I'm not sure. Something that goes by the name is the heat, the word is how it can balance the universe. It's not easy.
Oh, thermodynamics of a black hole?
The point
it turns out that this fact that you are, quote, radiating matter from the black hole, actually from just outside the black hole, is the way around that problem. And in fact, that's good thinking, because that's exactly what led Hawking to it.
So it stops it from heating up then ridiculous temperatures and gives you
energy to stay back. Yeah. Well, see, you got two thermodynamic problems. If it's going to be in equilibrium with the rest of the universe, and thermodynamics says it has to be. One is it sucks in all the matter and energy that's around it, you know, such as starlight, so why does it heat up to some enormous temperature? And the other is, since it sucks in all the matter and doesn't give any out, well, if it doesn't give any out, then the black body law says it's a zero temperature, and how is this possible in a microwave background radiation of 3 degrees above absolute zero? And you solve all of that by taking this quantum mechanics into effect. There is some... Hawking himself wrote another Scientific American article, which you can read. It's a number of years back, and you can find it in the index. There's an index in every December issue, if you want to go into that. It's called The Quantum Mechanics of Black Holes. Or it's in the new collection of Scientific American articles published by Freeman called Cosmology Plus One. The plus one being an article on intelligent life in the universe by Carl Sagan.
As far as I can tell, it would be random of which particle got sucked in.
It is random, yes. So you don't have a net...
No,
you could in principle, but I mean, always in thermodynamics, you could have weird things happening. All of the matter in this room, all the air in this room, could suddenly start moving in just two opposite directions, pile up in those two corners, and everybody in the middle dies of suffocation. But when you calculate how likely that is, you find, you know, in practice, it just doesn't happen. You know, it would not happen once, it would not be expected to happen once in the lifetime of the universe. And this room hasn't been here that long. Oh, thanks. I haven't been here. I shouldn't make these generalizations.
With black hole mechanics and energy moving, aren't you describing simply a matter in and matter not?
You seem to have a talent for asking me questions using terminology that I don't understand.
Okay.
What do you mean by matter, antimatter, not? Wait a minute. What do you mean if you have interference with your matter?
Huh?
What do you mean if you have interference with your matter?
Here's your matter.
Okay. Well, which matter? The matter inside the black hole?
No. No. Right.
The matter that's being created. Why don't you talk to me afterwards, because I have the feeling this is going to take, you know, 15 minutes to get straight. What? No. I'll put it at the bottom of my list if you like. The list is about like this. First thing I got to read is the Viking special issue of Journal of Geophysical Research. That's this thick. So it's going to take a while. Okay, anyway, well, I've said it, essentially, and now I want to show you the slide. So if we could have... Thank you. So we could have the slides on, please, and the lights off. This is a picture of a supernova in the galaxy NGC 7331 in Pegasus. It happened in 1959. On the picture on the left, you see it before the supernova happens, and in the picture
picture, somebody sitting in the beam, could you move just a little bit? The picture on the right, that is during the maximum of the supernova. It's not too obvious from this picture because the galaxy is an extended source, the supernova is a point source, and no photograph is faint. But in fact, the supernova is about as bright as all of the other 100 billion stars of its galaxy put together. And that is very typical. Here is the Crab Nebula. I think you can see, I think you can see that there is a, pointer. Now where is it? Plug in, wonderful. All right, in the center, here, it's one of this way. Right there, see the double star? Not really a double star, they're not close enough together to be a true double star, but you know, two stars close together in the picture. That one, the lower right-hand one, is the remnant of the supernova. And this is the cloud of dust that's expanding outwards away from the supernova at 600 miles a second, supernova remnant. Here are pictures of the pulsar taken with a very special photographic technique, the effect of which, I'm not going to try to describe how they did it, but the effect of which is if you took a picture every 300th of a second. Now, in fact, it wasn't that simple because it isn't bright enough to do that, but that's the effect. Here's a brightness chart down there on the bottom, and if you look up there at the top, notice our double star. We start out at phase zero. Phase means we're going to go through one whole cycle, and then it repeats the cycle again at 1.0. It does its 30th in 1/30th of a second. One entire cycle is the 30th of a second. There's the double star. You can see that our remnant is almost invisible, getting bright, as bright as the other star, faint, invisible, suddenly brighter than the other star. That's the main peak. And then faint, and then we start the cycle over again. All that 30 times every second.
Is that light waves?
Those are light waves. In fact, it's X-rays too. Crab Nebula emits everything, whole electromagnetic spectrum, it's all in phases. This is an artist concept painted by Roland Cohen at Griffith Observatory of Cygnus X1, assuming that it is a black hole, or at least some very compact matter. Sucking matter out of HDE 226868, which is the star here. And of course, we had to use some artistic license in how a blue supergiant looks close up. We have no idea of what that is. Detailed calculations show that the matter would get sucked out, form a disk in which it spirals around, called the accretion disk. It's denser and denser and denser. You notice most of that disk is only that hot. In the very, very middle there, she's exaggerated the size of the black hole, the Schwarzschild radius. She had to, or she wouldn't be able to see it. And just around that, in a shell that is so thin that you can't even see it at this scale, it would turn first orange and then white and then orange and yellow and white and blue white and then hotter and hotter and hotter still. And finally, the very, very inner edge is the place where the X-rays come from. So this is the way it might look if indeed you have a black hole there, if that is in fact what's going on. Here's the globular cluster. See what I mean? They're very beautiful. This is M13, the constellation Hercules. I want to mention, by the way, the plaques on the two Pioneer Jupiter spacecraft and the plaque on the front of the record on the Voyager spacecraft have that diagram that looks like a 14-legged spider that you may remember if you've seen the pictures to show where we are in the universe. And I can now explain how that diagram works. It indicates our distance from each of 14 different pulsars. You see, and each of the pulsars is identified by its frequency. And so that is a unique way of specifying exactly where we are. There's another branch of the diagram which indicates our distance from the center of the galaxy. Likewise, a message to identify us, a radio message, has been sent by the Arecibo Radio Telescope in Puerto Rico, which is the biggest on Earth, towards the globular cluster M13. From his M13 is 13,000 light years away. So if we got an answer, it would be 26,000 years after it was sent. But the theory was the beam of the telescope, when used as a transmitter, is just about the size of that cluster. And so you are very efficiently using that beam. You're transmitting to about 1 million separate stars at once.
Question?
Yeah. Pulsars do not last all that long, and in that case, you know, we have to assume that a technology that is bright enough to be able to find this thing in the first place, a fairly advanced technology, has been around for a long while and has some old records, and they would be able to figure out, if they pick it up in the next few million years, they would be able to figure out not only where we are, but the date of launching from the various frequencies, because these are the frequencies as they were at the time of launch, the date of launching to plus or minus 1 year. That's how precise these pulsar frequencies are and how precisely they can be measured, because, you know, they happen so often, they happen over and over and over again. And so you can observe millions of them in a short period of time and get the frequency to easily 8 decimal places. Actually, they did get an answer to the message from M13, you know, with a description of what life is like on the Earth in a coded picture form. 2 days after the message was sent, a printed message appeared on the observatory teletype, and nobody was able to figure out where it came from, and so it was probably real, which said, "Message received, help is on the way, M13. This is M87. Here you see skeletal funny spots. The star dots are stars in our own galaxy, much closer, they just happen to be in the same direction. The fuzzy dots are other galaxies. But these little fuzzy things all around us, about 500 of them known, those are globular clusters revolving around these other galaxies. It's a very interesting situation. It's fairly symmetrical. Number of stars in the galaxy increases sharply as you move in towards the center. All this is overexposed. You can't see that. In fact, it's much brighter here than it is here. And then you have a halo of globular clusters having the same distribution, more and more globular clusters you get in the center. And in each of the globular clusters, there is such a distribution, spherical distribution. And furthermore, this galaxy is a member of a cluster of galaxies which has that same kind of distribution. So you have sphere on top of sphere on top of sphere, and that sounds very much like a sort of situation in which if it went just a little bit too far, it could produce black holes in any of the number of scales. Here is the central region of M87, and you can see the very intense bright thing there at the middle, which may be a black hole of 5 billion solar masses sucking in matter around it, and there is the bright jet, the fainter jet that's not shown in this picture, it's going off in another direction. I think that's not a picture. No, this is an artist's conception of the inside of a black hole. So, thank you very much. Hope you come back and see us. I was right. This is the shortest lecture I gave this term. Bob, you have been sitting in the back, and I assume the fact that you were sitting in the back rather than running in and out means there has not been an aurora. Am I correct? Couldn't see one about a half an hour ago. Okay.
Same color as mercury vapor.
Now, of course, if you have more questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them anyway. I've probably told you almost as much as I know about black holes. What I would like to do, though, is take them from the floor rather than individually up here, because otherwise everybody asks the same question over and over again.
Jim, you forgot to mention we live in a black hole, the galaxy.
Oh, right, yeah, the universe, you mean. Yeah, you're right. I did forget to mention that.
Slav?
Yeah.
Is there any explanation of those jets?
Apparently they're the result of some sort of explosion. Listen, though, let me take questions from the floor, please, because I for reasons I just said. So why don't you ask me that one from the floor?
I just wondered if you have any other questions.
We have, I think, scheduled in the back there of this. Oh, they're not? Okay. Well, in that case, the answer is no. The remaining two lectures in this series are listed on this sheet, however.
They will be listed.
Are there more of those back
there? Some are there.
Palm Beach. Oh, good heavens.
I just wanted you to know.
Sorry about that.
More than you probably enjoyed the lecture.
I'm glad you did.
What's the escape velocity of our galaxy?
Yeah. Let's see, from our distance from the center, what you do is you take circular velocity and multiply it by the square root of 2, okay? And so multiply it by 1.4, and the circular velocity, which is the speed of our sun around the center, roughly about 250 miles a second, so multiply that by 1.4 and you got it.
Is that what the galaxy?
That's for anything.
What's the circular velocity for Earth?
Circular velocity for Earth is,
what's the
circular velocity is the speed you need for a circular orbit. And
at what distance?
At a given distance, and the escape velocity from that distance is the circular velocity at that distance times the square root of 2. Thank you.
What was that jet? Was that
Let me take questions from the floor, please. This is the second time it's been asked, you know, and that is just what I say. I want to take them from the floor so I won't have to answer the same thing over and over. Okay, could everybody sit down if you have questions, and I'll be happy to take them as long as you want. Well, within practical limits, we have to get out at some point. Okay, a couple of people have asked me the nature of those jets. We don't know in detail, that's the short answer, but apparently there are explosive phenomena in the centers of a number of galaxies. Possibly it happens to all galaxies at one time or another in their lives. Possibly it's related to the quasar phenomenon. We simply do not know. And very often what you have is two different things going in opposite directions, as though you had an explosion which sent out puffs of gas in two different directions. A very common kind of radio source is a galaxy in the middle, often with a bright center, and then two blobs of radio-emitting material on either side of it, way outside the boundary of the galaxy, and with no visible indication whatever of anything being there. And that may very well be the same phenomenon. You know, they spread out and they become this sort of thing. Believe it or not, not only a star could survive, most of the star could survive the experience of having a supernova go off right next to it, but so could planets. You would lose some material from the planet, but it actually turns out that the pulse of heat, although very strong, is over so fast that the heat just doesn't have time to penetrate into the interior of the planet very far. So you boil off, you know, the outer few hundred miles and the rest of it stays behind. But what happens is this. Here's a planet, or here's a star, going around the star which just becomes a supernova in a circular orbit. All of a sudden, the amount of matter that is there in the center, i.e. the gravity that's holding an orbit, becomes very much less, but the speed at which it's moving, of course, you know, becomes the same. And so that speed suddenly goes from being a circular velocity for the old strength of the gravitational field up to escape velocity and way beyond. And so what happens is the star or the planet goes flying off at some very high speed. Now, we know of a number of cases in the sky where there are what are called runaway stars, which are a bunch of stars moving out in several directions from some location where there has been a lot of recent star formation, and therefore where you might have expected some supernovae from the very most massive stars, which have already gone through their lifetimes and disappeared. In the Orion region of the sky, where there's just a hotbed of star formation, has been for some millions of years, there are three stars that are coming out in all directions, AE Arietis, Mu Columbi, and another one I can't remember. And those are moving at just a reasonable kind of speed for them to have had that, several hundred miles a second, for them to have that kind of origin. So it really seems awfully ungrateful. You know, the star becomes a supernova, and its loyal companion survives through that entire thing, only to be thrown off into the cold of interstellar space. Question here. Okay, the question is it true that I'm going to be teaching a class here at some time in the immediate future and or doing lectures? And the answer is, I didn't know there was talk about it. The CIA will be around to see you in the morning. But in fact, this has been discussed. I would very much like to do it. It seems to be impossible for the fall just because of the short time scale involved versus uncertainties about money. What I would very much like to be able to do, you know, you got all this tremendous series of space events coming up from December through September of next year, and I'm going to be away covering Pioneer, Venus, the two Voyager, Jupiter flybys. If I can make it, the total eclipse of the Sun, which is the last one we'll be able to see from the contiguous U.S. in this century, the first flight to the shuttle orbiter into space, the Pioneer 11 arrival at Saturn, you know, all of this happening in a 10-month period is incredible. And I'm hoping to be away and cover all that, report it for National Public Radio, come back, you know, and have millions of lectures to give you thereafter. What I'd love to be able to do is teach a course on what is known now about the solar system in September and then come back in May. Turns out there's a gap in there, probably in May, April and May, you know, just about long enough to teach a half-term course in which, you know, somebody could take it who hadn't taken the other one, but it would the real value of it would be for somebody that had taken both, you know, just for a comparison. Really give you a chance to see large blocks of science in action. Well, that's fine, but if we can't do it, we can't do it, you know. And at the moment, from what I'm told, it looks as though the astronomy department, which is what I would be teaching under, you know, just isn't going to be able to pull it off. It'd be nice, but they just, it's not so much a matter of they know they don't have the money, as it's just that they don't know, you know, and they've got to be able to decide, and they can't decide on this time scale. All of that is unrelated to the question of whether I would give lectures. You understand I'm going to be away for most of the year. So basically what it comes down to is you might get two lectures from me, say one in September and one in April or May. And, well, you know, lobby with your friendly local planetarium, who are the kind sponsors, and also the astronomy department, I suppose. At the moment, I would say the chances for that probably look pretty good. You know, we have discussed it, but nothing definite has been said. So thank you very much for the question, which was the most kind one. I wish I could give you a more definitive answer, but, you know, at the moment, things are just in a state of flux, and I think I listed them for you flux by flux.
Okay, quick, easy question. Where did you get your Venus radar slides? Either where did you copy them, or space slides?
Okay, yeah, that Venus radar slide is a slide that I made myself with my own little macro lens on my own little camera, and I got of a print, a publicity print, you know, press release print from Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which I can get being a newsman, you see. And there are advantages. Sure, you know, phone. Talk to me afterwards and I'll give you a name and a phone number. You ought to be able to get it because you're doing all that stuff. I suppose in principle, I have not heard that discussed, but it's possible. I mean, it's possible somebody's discussing it. I just can't say. You know, I warned you, I know less about black holes than I do about the rings of Uranus, and there's a good example. It may very well be the biggest thing in black hole theorizing right now, and I just never heard it. That is how Hawking gets his mini black holes, and I'm sorry, I started to say that, then got diverted onto the bit about the quantum mechanics of black holes, never got back to it, so thank you. Yeah, that's presumably how it would have happened, how the mini black holes would have been created. By the way, if everybody hasn't heard the word, know the Siberian explosion in 1908 was not caused by a mini black hole hitting the Earth, because it would have come right through the Earth, and there would have been an equally strong event on the other side that would have been detected, and it was not. Okay, so the one piece of, you know, that some turkey thought was observational evidence for it, nobody else ever took it very seriously, has been shot down. The Siberian explosion was due to the impact of a comet, which is a truly remarkable phenomenon. And I don't think we have to go any further. You can understand the physics of that, too, from what I told you. Because remember, the heavier the star, the hotter it's got to be inside. That means the faster it's using up its fuel. Now, of course, it has more fuel being heavier, but it turns out that it uses up that fuel much faster by proportion than it has more fuel. And so it just, you know, just runs out of it real fast.
So during that course of your lecture, you're talking about the fact that you wonder why there aren't even more black holes.
Well, in human history, you know, that's only a few thousand years out of a history of the galaxy that's, oh, something of the order of 15 billion. We don't know that number very well. There are hundreds of supernova remnants known. Yes. Stars are still forming in many places throughout the galaxy, though, so it's not surprising there are still lots of them left. Mm-hmm. No, it's just, you know, mildly statistically anomalous that in human history there happen not to have been more of them. But go back over some astronomical timescale and the number of supernova remnants that we can observe is quite in line with what you expect.
But when they do disappear,
there are First, they become supernovae, in any case. The question is whether the supernova remnant ever then becomes a black hole. All stars heavier than a certain mass, roughly twice the mass of the Sun, become supernovae, or else our theories are totally wrong, one or the other. On present understanding, all such stars become supernovae. The majority of those supernovae can become neutron stars. So the question is whether any of them ever match something else. And our Sun will not, no.
Then our Sun couldn't become a nova.
No, it could not, because our Sun is not a member of contact binary. Okay, remember a nova? It's really sort of weird. A nova is not a normal circumstance. A supernova is. And yet, novae are much commoner than supernovae. A nova is a freak case where you have a star that happens to be a member of contact binary, and that's a freak case. And then the contact binary evolves, and you get the nova phenomenon, and you get it over and over again. Because, you know, the other star, the evolving star, keeps trying to become a red giant. And so every few hundred or few thousand years, you get another nova explosion. But that is a freak circumstance. Most stars of those masses do not ever become novae because they're not members of contact binaries. On the other hand, every star that is really heavy becomes a supernova. Okay? So it's normal for those stars to become supernovae. But novae are so much commoner than supernovae just because low-mass stars are so much commoner than high-mass stars that even freak low-mass stars are found in greater number than even normal high-mass stars. That and the fact that the novae do it over and over, whereas the high-mass stars do it all, the supernovae do it only once. It's sort of like a four-legged ant is not normal, right? They're supposed to have six. A four-legged elephant is normal. But there are so many more ants in the world than there are elephants that probably there are more four-legged ants in the world than there are four-legged elephants. You see what I mean? And yet, the four-legged elephants are normal and the four-legged ants are not, even though there are more of them. All right? The same way, novae are commoner than supernovae, but they're freak circumstances, nonetheless.
Well, can you see any now in the sky or not?
There is no nova now. There was one 2 years ago.
There is one now.
There is one now.
No, it's Serpentis 1978.
Fantastic. How bright is it? Do you see it with naked eye?
About fifth magnitude, fourth magnitude, probably.
Fantastic. Nova Serpentis. What's it?
Can't see.
Because of the light pollution, you mean? Yeah, okay. Well, you got in the country alone.
Well, go out to the observatory.
Yeah, Nova Serpentis. Huh. Which surface?
That one, I don't remember right offhand because my patrol area is south of the equator. From south of the equator, I have Dow Chemical to fight.
Can't fight.
Yeah, I promised I wasn't going to talk about him, too. Well, you know, I said as much as I can say about that. And mainly what I said is, in the first place, I suspect that's a mathematical fiction. In the second place, we just don't know enough to be able to go that far. That is theory that is too far from the observations, in my opinion. In the third place, I don't know enough general relativity that I really feel competent to talk about it. Any further than that?